Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder. It can cause chronic pain, multi-organ failure, and stroke, and affects an estimated 100,000 people in the United States, most of them African American. It's also a disease that few people know about or understand. Lack of awareness means lack of research dollars, and in some cases, lack of care for those with the disease. This hour, we'll find out what it's like to live with sickle cell disease. I'll talk to a mother who has two children with the disease. I'll also talk to a father and a daughter. His daughter has grown up with this disease. We'll find out what treatments are available, what the needs are, and what the future might hold. And if this is something you've had experience with, we'd also love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest today is Dr. Anjali Sharath Kumar, Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. Dr. Sharath Kumar, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And first, before we get started, let's try to understand this disease. As I said, it's an inherited blood disorder. What does it do?
So it affects the red blood cells in our body. And red blood cells are very vital for our survival because it carries a protein called hemoglobin. And all of us have heard about hemoglobin because when we go to doctor, you know, doctor says, hey, your hemoglobin is 13, 12, whatever. So hemoglobin is a protein which carries oxygen and it provides oxygen to every cell in our body. So normally these red cells are donut shaped when they have normal hemoglobin and they can squeeze through the blood circulation, you know, with small vessels and different organs like brain and, you know, kidney. Now, in sickle cell disease, this hemoglobin is molecule is a little bit crooked. And what happens is that there is a protein and there is a change in this protein. And as a result of that, this hemoglobin actually sickles these red cells. And instead of a donut shape, these red cells actually become like a tool, sickle, you know, which is used right. in the farming. Yeah. And so when they sickle, you know, this happens particularly when the blood vessels narrow down and these red cells sickle and they stick to each other.
So they can't travel through the blood vessels.
Absolutely. And when they cannot travel through the blood vessel, the blood supply to the organ is affected, you know. And less oxygen is provided to this tissue, and it can cause, various symptoms of sickle cell disease.
When a child is born with sickle cell disease, this is a recessive gene.
Mm-hmm.
So both parents need to be carriers of this recessive gene.
Correct.
And when a child is born with sickle cell disease, is it something that we discover right away? Is this something that would be discovered on the first day of their life?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the major advance in our epidemiological understanding of sickle cell disease, that sickle cell screening is available through the newborn screening program. And so pretty much within first couple of weeks, we know that child has a sickle cell disease or a trait. And, you know, when a child has a trait, they carry one gene with sickle cell disease, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when child has a disease, they have both the genes, which come from one from mom, one from dad. And so it's actually, you know, newborn screening has been a blessing because we can diagnose it very early.
But there is not a cure at this point, at least not an easy cure to this disease. When a child is born with sickle cell disease, what does that mean for that child? What are the parents told about what their child will experience?
Yeah. And, you know, when I actually I signed the newborn screening reports, and whenever I have signed a report that child has a sickle cell disease, you know, it breaks my heart because we actually call the families, we counsel them, but we pretty much tell them that your child may have to live with this. And the reason I use word may is because now we have different curative options which are looking very close or which are available now, and some of them will be available in near future. But 10 years ago, we used to kind of tell that, you know what, this is going to be a lifelong condition and, you know, you will have to live with it. Its complications, what we can do is to reduce the symptoms. You know.
And when you say a lifelong condition, what is the life expectancy for someone who's born with sickle cell disease?
Yeah, so I think now we are seeing patients with sickle cell disease in their mid-50s, you know, and this is a great achievement. But if you go back in 60s or 70s, you know, 60% of the baby children used to die due to sickle cell disease before their third birthday.
Their third birthday.
Correct.
And,
correct.
And an article I read recently said that 30 is considered to be the life expectancy for many people with sickle cell disease.
And that is correct. Yes, yes. And so, yeah.
We are going to talk about treatments. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about things that are on the horizon and what research can possibly tell us, and, mm-hmm. and maybe efforts to get more research dollars focused on this disease as the hour goes on. Dr. Anjali Sharathkumar is going to stay with us. Again, she's Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology and Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. But we also want to learn more about what it's like to live with this disease and to parent a child with this disease. And with me now is Lena Hill. She's Interim Chief Diversity Officer and Associate Professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. She is the mother of a daughter and son who both have sickle cell disease. Lena, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Charity.
Tell me a little bit about your kids. I know that your daughter is 15 years old, Caitlin. Your son is 10 years old. When did you discover that your children had sickle cell disease?
Yes, well, as Dr. Sharathkumar noted, this is now a part of newborn screening. So we were actually living in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And when we had Caitlin, we had no idea that there was a possibility she would have sickle cell. I knew that I had the trait, but being born in the 1970s, that was not a consistent part of newborn screening. But my mother was a nurse, and so she sort of was ahead of the curve. But my husband had no idea. So a few weeks after Caitlin was born, we received a call telling us about the results of the newborn screening that Caitlin did have sickle cell disease.
And what was your reaction?
We were shocked. I was familiar with sickle cell. I have a cousin who has sickle cell. So I was familiar with the disease, but I had no idea that there was a possibility that our children could have sickle cell. Now, with our second, with Michael Carl, at that point, of course, we did know that was a possibility, and we opted to learn at the time that we, I guess, around the time of the amniocentesis that we wanted to know whether he would be affected. And so we learned early with him. And again, that was devastating because we had been living with Caitlin and we knew what it meant.
Tell me what it meant to Caitlin in those early years.
It was really difficult, more difficult than we expected, if I would be honest. We thought, you know, we have supportive family, we are educated, we'll do all the research, we'll do everything we can to take care of her and make sure that she doesn't suffer the most difficult aspects of the disease. But you find out very quickly that this is an individualized disease and it manifests itself differently in each person. So for Caitlin, for all newborns and infants, when they have a fever above 101.5, you want them to be immediately hospitalized because their immune systems are compromised. And in case there's any kind of serious infection brewing, you really want to have some antibiotics on board early as a preventative measure. Well, babies might get temperatures a lot. So we spent a lot of time in the hospital. Before the age of 2, she was hospitalized, I want to say something like 20 times. And maybe we were being overzealous. When someone's an infant and they can't speak, they can't articulate their needs, you take very seriously any time they seem to be sick. So Caitlin spent a lot of time in the hospital, which meant we spent a lot of time in the hospital. And as first-time parents, it was very scary. And then she started to do a bit better. But unfortunately, one of the most severe complications of sickle cell is stroke. That only affects about 10% of people with sickle cell. But unfortunately, that was one of the complications Caitlin had, that the disease really was attacking her neurological system.
How old was she when she had her stroke?
She had a TIA, which is a transient ischemic attack, a sort of mini stroke in layman terms, when she was 4. So I was actually pregnant with Michael Carl. It demonstrated just as a stroke would in an adult, although the reasons are very different. But, you know, we were getting her ready for a bath and, you know, part of her face fell and she lost her balance. And, you know, we knew without anyone telling us that she was in the midst of a stroke. And at this point, we were in Iowa City and took her straight to the ER. And so that was her first, you know, event in terms of a stroke. Unfortunately, it was not her last.
You mentioned that you were in Iowa City. And I'm curious, because you moved to Iowa City and you are living with this disease that primarily affects African Americans. You moved to Iowa, which is not as diverse as many other places. Did that create challenges for you in seeking care?
Well, the university did an exceptional job. My husband and I were hired as professors in the English Department and African American Studies program. As a part of our recruitment, when we came for our initial campus visits, the department asked, you know, are there other things you'd like to know about the university, about life in Iowa City? And we actually requested to meet with members of the hematology team, the pediatric sickle cell program. And so before we ever accepted jobs here, we had a chance to sit down with the doctors and understand what care would be like.
So you knew, and you had to make sure that you knew before moving here that you were going to have the support that you needed. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Lena Hill. She is Interim Chief Diversity Officer and Associate Professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. And today we're talking about her personal life. She's also the mother of a daughter and son who both have sickle cell disease. Also with us, Dr. Anjali Sharath Kumar, Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. We'll find out more about this disease as the hour goes on, treatments, research, and what the future may hold. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about sickle cell disease. Sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder. It affects an estimated 100,000 people in the United States, most of them African American. This is a disease that not a lot of people know about. And I want to do a little contrast here. We'll talk about it more later on. But 100,000 people in the United States live with sickle cell disease. ALS, 30,000. Cystic fibrosis, again, about 30,000 people. And we all know at least something about ALS. We all remember the ice water challenge. We all know at least something about cystic fibrosis. But sickle cell disease is a disease that not as many people know about, not as many people understand. And that can also mean a lack of research dollars and in some cases a lack of care for those with the disease. Right now, we're talking about what it's like to live with this disease. With me is Lena Hill. She has a 15-year-old daughter with the disease and also a 10-year-old son with the disease. And Lena, just before the break, we were talking about your daughter's first stroke when she was 4 years old. In the wake of that stroke, what kind of treatment did she have to go through to keep her relatively healthy and alive?
Well, all children with sickle cell disease have what we call transcranial Dopplers, which are ultrasounds of the brain to see if they're at risk for stroke. So Caitlin had been having that. Because her first stroke was not a full-blown stroke, it was a mini stroke, we weren't sure which direction we would go. The only real treatment for stroke, or if you're at risk for stroke, is chronic transfusion. So we began looking into that, and ultimately that is the direction we went. And so chronic transfusion means that you try to manage the amount of blood that is affected with the sickled cells. So you try to keep that beneath 30%. Caitlin began with having just traditional transfusions, but quickly moved to having exchange transfusions. So she was really at the forefront of having a double lumen port, which allowed her to have exchange transfusions, which are more effective because you're removing the sickle blood as you are putting in the new blood.
So you're taking all of the blood out of her body and replacing it.
Not all. You're okay. Keeping the sickle blood beneath 30%.
Okay.
And then over a 4 to 5 week period, it creeps back up with the goal of never allowing it to be higher than 50%. So she started having chronic transfusions and was on that program for many years.
So when you say chronic transfusions, I mean, how often did she have to go through this procedure?
She had them every 4 to 5 weeks. She then continued, unfortunately, to have stroke-like events and then had a full-blown stroke, which is really unfortunate because that's the only real intervention that's available. So when she was 9 and came home from vacation Bible school one day and came into our room and said, I can't move my hand or my arm. And you're just sitting there. I mean, my husband and I were just sitting in the room talking, and she comes in and, you know, you're trying to be calm and you say, are you sure? And you have a 9-year-old looking at her arm saying, I'm really trying hard to bend it. And I can't wiggle my fingers. And that's how it is. I mean, that's how a stroke manifests itself. And so we realized at that time that chronic transfusion was not doing the work that we'd hoped it would do.
So what were your options at that point?
At that point, we called our team and told them we were on our way to the emergency room, and they called the ER and let them know that we were on the way. The immediate treatment is transfusion, even when you're in the midst of a stroke. So they do that very quickly, get everything going to have that set up. And, you know, you have a 9-year-old, so her major concern once we got there was, you know, I'm hungry. Can I have some McDonald's? And the funny thing was, we realized she was regaining movement when she was able to reach for a French fry herself. So kids are still kids.
You did pursue another treatment after dealing with this chronic transfusion and the strokes. She had a cord blood transplant. Tell me what that means.
Yes. Well, at the point that we realized the chronic transfusions were not working, the only other option is transplant. And transplant is only available to those people suffering with the disease in really critical ways, unless you have a perfect match available. And things have changed even in the 5 years since Caitlin had her transplant. But at that point, it was really quite experimental. So you immediately start looking for a match on the registry, the National Registry. We did not find a good match for a bone marrow transplant. The only match we found was a cord blood transplant, which comes from an infant. So Caitlin found a 5 of 6 match. So a 6 of 6 would be a perfect cord blood transplant match. So once we found that, we looked around the country at different centers that were doing those kinds of transplants and found that St. Louis Children's Hospital had a program. And so we began to investigate that and ultimately decided that that is where Caitlin would have her transplant. And I have to say, our team here at the University of Iowa worked really wonderfully with that team, but it did mean that we had to relocate to St. Louis for several months.
That experience, the transplant experience, is excruciating. We don't have time to talk about all the details, but just give me an idea of what it was like for her to go through that procedure.
It is tough. What I will say is it's not as tough when you're a kid because children are so incredibly resilient. But you go through chemotherapy and all of that goes along with that. It is a difficult experience. We were away from home, but we had a really wonderful support of our community. I would say the most difficult part really is after. People think of, you know, the moment you're in the hospital and you're restricted, and she could not leave her room for the entire time that she was in the hospital. And that is difficult.
And for how long was she there?
She was there for almost 6 weeks. Wow. And they were very careful with her, but they bring in so many different supports. The whole point there was keep the kids up and moving. So she had everything from art therapy to music therapy to physical therapy to occupational therapy. So she had a very busy schedule, but it's difficult. You know, your kid gets really sick, you know, you lose your hair. And then just being in that world with other parents. Caitlin wrote a wonderful story as she was there because she wanted to think about what was going on in the hospital at night. And she always reminds me that the other two characters in the story, there were three characters, were other kids on the transplant unit that we were getting to know as parents, but she was only hearing about, and she made them characters in the story. Neither of those children are alive today. And she often will remind me that she's the only one in her story that's still with us.
Wow. How is her health now?
She's doing really well. She had some graft versus host disease of the skin. So graft versus host can affect different organs. It can be really bad if it affects the gut, the liver, or the skin. But Caitlin's is mostly resolved at this point. And so she's doing well. She's cured of sickle cell disease.
What kind of lasting effects? I mean, she's been through these mini strokes and a major stroke. What kind of lasting effects does she have from this fight with sickle cell?
For her, not really much. It's strange in that my son, my 10-year-old, has not had a full-blown stroke. He's had only what we call silent strokes that show up in different imaging but don't manifest physiologically. But he's actually having a more difficult time in terms of how those silent strokes have impacted mm-hmm. him than Caitlin, who's had a full-blown stroke.
Your son, as you mentioned, is 10. You're dealing with sickle cell with him. Are you looking for an opportunity to do a transplant? Is that a possibility for him?
We have. Unfortunately, at the same time that we were getting ready for Caitlin to go in to transplant, we realized through the transcranial Doppler test that he was at increased risk for stroke, which is really unfortunate. So he started chronic transfusion at the time that we were getting ready to take her into transplant. So he's been on a chronic transfusion program since he was 5. We've not been able to find a match. And thinking about your introductory notes about sickle cell and the awareness, well, for African-American men in particular, it's very hard to find a match on the national registry. But there's so many new advances happening. We're really hopeful that something less invasive, less difficult for him will become available in terms of a cure.
Why do you think we don't hear about sickle cell disease? Why do you think there's this lack of awareness?
I think it's because of the population that is affected. Unfortunately, many African Americans, people of color who suffer from sickle cell disease are not those who have the megaphone. They don't know people who have power and resources to shine a light on this disease. So that's what happens. Even though there are large numbers of Americans who are suffering with this disease, you don't hear it talked about half as much as other diseases where people know someone with it or really they're in a position of power to bring attention to it.
Well, Lena, I hope that both of your children get the care that they need and continue to do well. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Charity.
Lena Hill is Interim Chief Diversity Officer and Associate Professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about her children, her daughter and her son, who both live with sickle cell disease. And also, of course, still with me is Dr. Anjali Sharath Kumar, Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. And I realize that every case of sickle cell disease is somewhat different. Lena gave us some great examples that help us understand how people get treated for this disease. What other treatment options are there beyond these chronic transfusions?
So I think majority of the treatment options are currently focused on supportive care and chronic disease management. And the important things we start is this, as Lena mentioned, is these kids are prone for infections because their immune system is not as strong as normal kids. And so we start them on penicillin prophylaxis. You know, their red cells do not live as long as normal individual, you know, and so we give vitamin called folic acid on a regular basis. And one therapeutic option, which has been very promising to improve the overall outlook of sickle cell disease, is hydroxyurea.
And what is that?
So hydroxyurea is actually a chemotherapy drug. You know, it is used for various types of malignancies or cancers. And it has shown to improve the, reduce the sickle cell synthesis, but at the same time, increase the fetal hemoglobin. Now, fetal hemoglobin is a type of hemoglobin we have when we are in the uterus. You know, we are in fetuses. And so that hemoglobin has more affinity towards oxygen. And so this hydroxyurea selectively increases the synthesis of this fetal hemoglobin and increases its concentration. And so it protects us from the sickling effect, you know. So it has significantly improved the overall course of sickle cell disease in terms of, you know, reducing pain crisis, reducing organ damage. You know, it not only affects the hemoglobin synthesis, but it also acts on various blood vessels in our body. And it keeps our blood vessels more healthy and prevents sticking of this sickled hemoglobin to the blood vessels. All right. And so as a result, you know, the flow of the blood is maintained or reasonably better than a regular sickle cell patient. So we are significantly encouraging this therapy.
You mentioned the use of antibiotics as a sort of a preventative. I mean, the things you're talking about, they sound like treatments that have a lot of side effects as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm. So generally, I mean, we try penicillin, and it's a well-tolerated medication. Sometimes it does have some gastrointestinal symptoms, but most of our infants and kids tolerate it very well. You know, we have some alternatives if they cannot tolerate penicillin. Yes, hydroxyurea does have side effects. As I mentioned, it's a cancer drug. Mm-hmm. And so it does fall your hair, you know, your nails become blue. Sometimes it affects your blood counts. You know, it can drop your total white cell count, you know, red blood cell count. And so we monitor these kids very, very closely.
And again, these are treatments, not cure. Lena was talking about going through the transplant process.
Mm-hmm.
What makes somebody a candidate for that? I mean, I can imagine people thinking, well, if getting a transplant cures it, why not get a bone marrow transplant?
So first of all, we have to remember that stem cell transplant is not like taking penicillin or hydroxyurea. I mean, this is the therapy which is associated with significant mortality. What I mean is transplant-related death.
Right, and so it's a possibly fatal treatment.
Correct. And also it has long-term complications. I mean, Caitlin, as mentioned by Alina, she was suffering from chronic graft-versus-disease for almost 2 to 3 years after her transplant. And so it has its own complications. Some of them are reversible. Some of them are not reversible. And so we have to be careful about offering stem cell transplant. And the biggest limitation also is availability of a match. You know?
Right, to be able to find a match to
Correct.
Get a transplant that's going to work. And, of course, we do see these be the match drives often associated with cancer treatments and cancer awareness. But it sounded like Lena was saying that push doesn't reach deep enough into the community that we need for treating sickle cell, because not as many African-American, particularly African-American men, are part of that registry.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we always have challenges about getting full match, you know, and sibling match is always the best, but followed by unrelated full match donors. And it does cause a lot of complications. So currently, we reserve transplant only for patients who have strokes or bad pain crisis.
Right. It's a treatment of last resort.
Correct.
We understand quite a bit about the gene that causes sickle cell disease. Is gene therapy the direction that you think treatment will go in the future?
Absolutely. I think there are exciting techniques are on the horizon. One of them is gene editing. We also are able to replace the gene and correct the gene. So I clearly see that as a near future for cure of sickle cell.
Okay, you said near future. How? I research works in a much longer timeline than most of us.
Correct. Well, I don't want to say, but I think in next 5 to 10 years, we are definitely going to see that cure. And I'm very, very excited about it because the data is looking promising as time is going.
We are going to take another short break this hour. We're talking about sickle cell disease, an inherited blood disorder. It can cause chronic pain, multi-organ failure, and stroke. It affects an estimated 100,000 people in the United States. Dr. Anjali Sharathkumar, Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology and Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa, is here with us today. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk with Amira and Aziz Boutali about their experiences. Amira has sickle cell disease. She's 14 years old. We'll talk about what it's like, again, to live with this disease. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about sickle cell disease. It's an inherited blood disorder. It's estimated to affect 100,000 people in the United States, most of them African American. It's a very difficult disease to live with. Treating the disease is also very difficult. With me this hour, Dr. Anjali Sharathkumar, Clinical Director of Pediatric Hematology and Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. And now I want to introduce two more people who know far more than they would probably like to about sickle cell disease. Aziz Boutali and his daughter Amira Boutali are here, and Amira was born with sickle cell disease. Aziz Boutali is associate professor in the Department of Oral Pathology, Radiology, and Medicine at the University of Iowa. Aziz and Amira, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
And Aziz, I'll give you the start, since Amira probably doesn't remember the very beginning of this story. When Amira was born, how long did it take for you to discover that she had sickle cell disease?
We found out when Amira was a little over 1 year old. Unlike in the United States, we were in Nigeria, where she was born, and the access to newborn screening is not available. So there was no way we could have found out a few weeks after she was born. However, she had an episode of malaria a few weeks after her first birthday, and she was in pain. And we took her to the hospital, and they did the malaria screen, but the doctor was a bit alarmed when he saw one of the red blood cells were sickled. And he asked me, "Do you know your daughter has sickle cell?" And I said, "No," because I knew I was AS, but my wife thought she was AA.
All right, so that means you were a carrier for this gene, but your wife had actually had a screening and thought that she was not a carrier. So this was something you actively sought to prevent and could not.
Yes, we had done that when we were dating back in medical school. Because I knew since I was a little kid, because my mom lost a few of her siblings to sickle cell disease. Oh. And her brother lost 3 kids to sickle cell disease, so I was very much aware. So I told my wife when we're dating that I needed to know if she was a carrier or she was, you know. And she did the test, and unfortunately, she was told that she was not a carrier. So we went ahead to get engaged. And it was not until Amira was diagnosed that it became a shock to both of us. So at that point, we needed to make a decision. But I told her, I said, the best way to support a sickle cell child is for both parents to be involved. That this has happened, then we have to move on with it and live together to be able to help Amira. And thereafter, Amira was placed on penicillin, which is the prophylactic antibiotics, as well as folic acid, which also helps with the red blood cells. But afterwards, she had a few episodes of crisis every now and then. Not as often as most other kids with sickle cell, maybe once in 3 months or once in 6 months, until she was about 3 and a half when I had to move to Scotland for my PhD. And she moved with me, with her mom. We also met, as soon as we got there, the first thing I did was to have access to the hematology team to let them know my daughter had sickle cell. And the doctor there, Dr. Wilkie, had a plan for her. And the plan worked very well. The crisis episode was a bit reduced. We were like once in 9 months hospitalized, as she was hospitalized in the hospital. So things were moving on very well.
Right. And that sounds like a lot to people who don't have a child who struggles with something like this, once every 9 months being hospitalized. But to you, that was a relief.
Well, it was. But if you understand what goes on before you take the child to the hospital, it was a big deal. The pain crises are not comparable to anything that you can think about.
Well, let's talk about the pain crisis. And Amira, I would love for you to tell us about it. What does it feel like? Can you describe what it feels like to have one of these pain crises?
I can't really say like how it hurts, because it hurts really bad. When I have a pain crisis, I can't really think about anything because it hurts so much. So the way I describe it to people is like, it's like somebody going into labor, but it's 10 times worse than the pain that they're having.
And you feel it everywhere in your body? No,
it starts in my stomach. And it wasn't until like I was 10, I started feeling it in my wrist and my arms and my legs. But mostly when I know I'm having pain in my stomach, I know I'm having a crisis. So I was aware of the pain and where it was. But when I was like trying to get it somewhere else, it was very hard for me to describe the pain because it was so different from my stomach aches. So, yeah.
Wow. And when you start to have this pain crisis, or you go to the hospital with this pain crisis, what can they do for you?
Really, I say nothing really works, because as soon as they get there, we put me on antibiotics to help the pain, sometimes morphine, sometimes just lay me off of morphine so that I don't get too addicted to it, maybe try Tylenol. But to me, something doesn't really help. I think sometimes it just goes away naturally, but I don't know what helps me exactly, because they try everything. And to me, it feels like it's getting worse, doesn't get better. So I don't know what exactly helps me.
Wow.
To this day, I still don't know, because it's really nothing.
Well, and Dr. Sharath Kumar, this is a very common part of sickle cell disease, this incredible and debilitating pain. And Amira just mentioned putting a child on morphine because of the pain. And there are other opioids, of course, that get used. We are in the midst of an opioid epidemic in this country. As a doctor, that must put you in a really frightening situation to almost have to give a child opioids to ease that pain.
Yeah, and that is absolutely correct. I think as we started to learn about the management of sickle cell pain, I think non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Motrin, has become the forefront. But also we took help from opioids, and we give sometimes bolus doses or sometimes continuous infusion. One thing which has become popular is patient-controlled analgesia. And so you are absolutely right about this, because I think we did control their pain, but quite a few kids, did become opioid dependent. And that's a really fine balance we are struggling about, managing these kids. Like, and as we are learning more about this sickle cell pain and chronic pain particularly, and our approach of treating with opioids, I think we are learning that that may not be a right approach. And we are midst of understanding that management of chronic pain in sickle cell disease. But you are absolutely right. It always gives a big ethical challenge when we put these kids on opioids. And most of the time, we do not have objective laboratory evidence to support that patient is actually in pain. We go by what patient tells.
Right.
And so that is the yardstick we use. And based on that, we actually treat. And clearly, we escalate our opioid management or dosing if the pain is not well controlled. And so you are right about that, that I think it has been giving a lot of pause to all of us, that are we really doing justice to these kids?
Well, and it's not a cure. It's a management
Absolutely.
Technique to get you through one of these episodes. Amira, growing up with this disease, being an elementary school student, what was that like, going to school with your peers who probably had never heard of sickle cell disease?
It was hard. I'm not going to lie. It was really hard because my eyes were always yellow. I still remember in fourth grade, I had to leave school because I had a play going on and my eyes were green. It's because there was something affecting my gallbladder and I had to leave school because of that. And everybody knowing, they were like, what is wrong with her? What is happening with her? Why is she never here? Because I really wasn't. To be honest, I haven't been to school for like a whole full year without going to the hospital for at least a couple of weeks.
Wow.
It's been really hard.
Did your teachers try to help other students understand what was going on?
To them, too, it was a shock because they really don't know. They're not doctors, so they have to, like, even research more.
Right, they may not have never had a student with sickle cell disease before.
So, like, in this winter, I couldn't go out and I had to stay in. So people were like, why does she have to stay in? Why can't she
go like anybody else? Right.
Yes, everybody wants to stay in. It was, like, they were just so confused on how I have these special things that I have to do. And they couldn't, you know, they couldn't understand how it felt for me, why I'm like this. It was really hard for them to get adjusted because even when I had friends, I had to break it down to them what it is so that they understand why I'm going through all of this. So they know that I'm not doing this because of this. I'm not doing this because of that. I'm doing this because I have sickle cell.
And, of course, elementary school students who are healthy, they engage in a lot of extracurricular activities. Gym class was something you couldn't be a part of either?
No.
So you couldn't go out for recess. You couldn't go to gym class. You couldn't join an after-school activity?
Mm-mm.
Wow. There came a crisis for you. Can you tell me what happened before you needed to get a transplant?
Yes.
Or you want your dad to tackle this one?
I can say it. I think I was having trouble breathing. So my oxygen was not above 90 like it was supposed to. And they said that if it doesn't go up in a couple of weeks when I come back, I need to be put on oxygen at home.
Wow.
So a couple of weeks, it was still around 70s. It wasn't going up like it was supposed to. So they decided to put me on oxygen at home. And I was taking the oxygen all over the house. It was an extended cord. But it wasn't up to it. Like, I came back until my next appointment. Nothing has changed. They said that if this doesn't help, they may need me to be on oxygen at school. And I really didn't want that because at the time I was in junior high and going
through
all that.
Which is hard enough.
Yeah. So they said, then that's when they gave me option the next time I went back and still nothing. They said that there's this trial kind of thing they're doing. It's a bone marrow transplant. You take blood from somebody else's bone marrow and give it to you, which will help with the sickle cells and help you feel much better. I was scared.
Yeah.
I seriously did not want to do it. I said, let's wait until the summer going into high school. My dad was like, no, because it's going to be better if you do it now, going into eighth grade. So then high school, you wouldn't worry about something like this because it's going to be harder in high school with the homework and everything. And I said, okay. I decided to go through with it. It was a hard decision that I had to make, but I knew I had to do it because I needed to get better and I needed to do this for me in the long run.
Right. Did you think about dying? I mean, that was a very real danger to you in this severe health crisis. Did you think about that?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not going to lie, I did. I didn't want to say it out loud because I've always known to be a fighter. Like, I stand. If I'm in pain, if I cry, like, I'm in pain, that means it hurts too much that I can't fart to explain. But I usually don't cry about these things. But when it came to the bone marrow transplant, I wanted to not do it. I wanted to cry because I was scared about dying. I was scared about a lot of things that was going to change in my body. Everything was just going to change. But most importantly, I was scared of my hair not falling out. I was terrified.
And did you lose your hair?
Yes.
Oh.
I told them,
it
number
looks
one thing.
Beautiful today.
Thank
and
you.
You look beautiful and healthy today.
Thank you.
And so the match for a transplant for you came from one of your brothers, right?
Mm-hmm. My baby brother. He's 6 now, so, and he still tells me, I mean, you remember when I saved your life?
He'll tell you that forever.
He still tells me.
So tell me about your health now. You are considered to be cured of sickle cell disease now.
Yes.
Because you've been through the transplant.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel?
I feel good. I think I feel great, to be honest. Sometimes I have stomach aches, but, you know, we're still trying to solve that problem. But other than that, I think I've been doing well. I'm able to do, like, other activities. I'm in cheerleading. I have basketball. I'm doing a lot of things in my life that I never thought I could do before. And people that know me now, they're like, how can you do all these things when you had all of this? And it's really nice to do all these things and be a normal teenager.
Yeah.
Because not all my life, I never thought like I could be a normal kid and go outside and do all these things that people are doing. And it's hard because sometimes I felt abnormal, but at the same time, I think of myself as special because I'm unique in my own way. And that makes me more special because of what I did and what I had.
And what you have overcome.
Yeah.
Aziz, it must just be amazing to be sitting next to your healthy daughter today.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know the old story from when before she was born and how my wife and I, you know, had to adjust to the reality of her being born with sickle cell disease.
Right. And you mentioned that your mother had lost siblings. She lost 7 siblings.
I couldn't even tell my mom
disease.
My daughter had sickle cell disease.
Oh.
Because I kept it away from my family until just a few years ago, you can imagine. But more importantly, the decision to have my little son be the donor was absolutely devastating for my wife. It was for me, but I just had to like put a good face. But my wife was broken, like having 2 kids to go into, you know, one into surgery, the other one waiting to get a transplant in chemo. But we just had to pull through it. And just for any other person, if it's available and they have a match, I think it's a good option. Amira is looking great. Amira can do everything. We're even trying to contain her to say, okay, Amira, take it easy. But she's full of life. She's ready to do anything. She's up to every challenge. So, and for my family, we're grateful. The team here at the University of Iowa, I cannot thank them enough. Both psychologically, medically, they were here. They were with us all through the game. Until tomorrow, they're still available for us. So,
and I know that you've worked to build the Sickle Cell Association of Iowa to try to bring together a community. I mentioned it's been difficult to raise awareness of this disease. Amira, what do you want people to know about sickle cell disease? Everybody listening right now.
I want them to know it affects mostly African Americans because there's not a lot of talk when it comes to sickle cell. Sickle cell needs to be one of the most things, like part of the things that people should talk about. Like we have ice bucket challenges for ALS. We know about all these AIDS, HIV. We need to know about sickle cell because it affects people. It impacts a lot of people's lives and body a lot.
Yeah.
Especially kids.
Well, hopefully word will get out. Hopefully more research dollars. Hopefully gene splicing, genetic treatment can give everybody the kind of bright future that you're facing right now. Amira, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Amira and Aziz Batali are here. Aziz Batali is an associate professor in the Department of Oral Pathology, Radiology, and Medicine at the University of Iowa. Amira has been cured of sickle cell disease through a transplant. And Dr. Anjali Sharath Kumar, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Dr. Anjali Sharath Kumar, Director of Pediatric Hematology and Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.